This is Blood and Firewater, a true crime comedy discussion type podcast. We shoot tequila and we chase over a case of murder. Just as a disclaimer, this podcast contains mature content not suitable for all ages, so listener's discretion is advised. I am your host, Rashad, and I would like to thank each and every one of you for tuning into the show. We promise not to be insensitive to the victims and respect their families. However, we will poke fun at other persons, places, and things involved with the case. We're not professionals, and we don't pretend to be. So, this season, we are going down an imaginary list of some really bad guys in the true crime universe. We're giving them a rating on our FTG scale, and at the end of this, I can't wait till the end of this. We're going to see who was the best worst serial killer. Because of Ed Kemper, we had to add some more numbers, but it's fine. After you hear this case, we're not adding any more numbers. Like, it's 17. 17 is high enough. Ed Kemper is our new leader on the leaderboard, Top and Dahmer. We didn't forget to give Albert Fish a number. I accidentally edited that part out, and I didn't realize it until like yesterday. So, Albert Fish has a 16 on the scale. So I mean, you really just have to remember the top three, which is Dahmer, Fish, and Kemper. But you know, they all have their own unique skill set. So, you know, you have to take that in consideration, along with, among other things, like how long were they unapprehended, you know, their victims and their mental state. We had a serial killer who actually lost points because everybody knew Ed Gein wasn't right. Everybody knew that. So, but first, if this is your first time listening, welcome to Blood and Firewater, a true crime comedy discussion type podcast. I'm your host, Rashad, and with me today, as always, is Dre. Second, we have a new segment of the show called the What's Poppin' Report, since a lot of these guys operated before any of us were here to talk about it. We hand the mic to Dre so he can tell us what was going on in the world the year our killer or killers were apprehended. But we moved it to the back of the show. It just seemed to make more sense that way. Lastly, if you would like to become a Bloody, please check out our Patreon. We have stickers and keychains. And as we get closer to our garage sale, I'll navigate through my garage to unearth my screen press, and we'll have t-shirts and tote bags coming soon with clever murder shit on them. A link to our Patreon will be in the bio of this episode, along with all of our socials. You can find us on Twitter at BFWPodSquad, Instagram, and Snapchat. Snapchat and Twitter at BFWPodSquad, Instagram at Blood and Fire. You know what? It's not even important. Come looking for me. I think you can find me. You're an investigator, right?
Yeah, me?
So for tonight's case,
I guess, you know. It depends on who you ask it.
So for tonight's case, I figured since I gave you just like a couple of letters to go off of, we're just going to go skinny dip right on in tonight's case. Are you cool with that?
That's cool.
The Otero family had just recently moved to Wichita, Kansas from Panama for the father's new job repairing aircraft. This was the first of the BTK killings that started January 15th, 1974. I think BTK takes the cake for having the longest run as far as of all the cases that we've covered. I think His run was like 17 years. The Oteros consisted of Joseph, 38, Julie, 33, and their children Charlie, Carmen, Danny, Joseph Jr., and Josephine. Josephine? Josephine.
I would say which one? Josephine. I've never heard of Josephine.
Okay. And Josephine Otero. The morning started like every morning. The kids varied in age, so they left for school in the morning in shifts. Some were in high school, some were in elementary school. So three of the older children had already left for the day, and that's when Raider came inside of 1834 Edgemoor. This is what happened according to BTK himself in his testimony in court. He cut the phone line before entering the house. It was about 7 to 7:30. He waited at the back door for someone to open, all the while starting to reconsider the act or fantasy, as he called it, until he quote-unquote realized he was inside the house with a pistol drawn on the remaining family inside of the house. Mr. and Mrs. Otero, Joseph Jr., and Josephine Otero. Now, at this point, Raider had no idea what he was doing, but he's got a gun, so he's somewhat in control of the situation. However, he can't get the family dog to show up. So he asked somebody to let the dog out. I believe he asked the father told the son. Semantics, I don't know. He cooked up a story that he was wanted by the police. He was hungry and he just wanted the car. Raider then led the family into a bedroom and bound them. Now, here's where this gets a little serial killer weird, I guess. Mr. Ortega had a cracked rib from a car accident and had to be repositioned, and the family complained about, well, you know, being tied up. So Raider was happy to make Mr. Ortega comfortable and loosen the knots, but, you know, still bound. Still expert level knots. Then the family is like, look, my guy, just take whatever you want. You can take the car, you can take the money, just go. So theirs is out. A little B&E, assault with a deadly weapon charge, I don't know what else, but that kind of time is doable. The family legit doesn't snitch and maybe goes to get some kind of like security system, you know, I don't know. But don't worry, that's going to come up later. But either way, Raider does not take either of these paths, but he made his own, and we will call that the psychopath. You got to give him some credit. This is his first time, okay? I know we talk about serial killers like a lot, or like just people killing people a lot, but like this...
I don't feel like we should give...
Okay. BTK tries to kill the father first by strangulation. He puts a bag over his head and ties it with cords. Mr. Ortega rips a hole in the bag, so Raider's got to go get another bag. Started doing it again. He thought he was dead. Boom, done. Moves over to the mother and believes that he strangled her, but she only passed out briefly. He moves over to Josephine, thought he choked her out, but also failed miserably. Then he put a bag over Joseph Jr.'s head. Mrs. Ortega wakes up and says, "Hey man, don't kill my son. Okay, my guy?" Kinda, you know, upset. Raider's like, "Hey, you're ruining my thing here. Even after all that strangling, no one's actually dead yet." Like, that was a whole bunch of strangling. Like, my man's got to be tired. Like, I ain't never strangled nobody, but like to strangle a whole family of people, it seems like exhausting. I'm just saying. Like, I'm surprised he didn't put a bag over the dog's head. Like, he tried to strangle the dog, too, and, like, that didn't work out either. But whatever. BTK's upset. Dennis Raider is BTK. I'm sorry. Like, I wrote both names in there because I was like, I don't know which one I want to use. So I just, like, spliced a whole bunch of them in there. So BTK, he's a little upset because everybody's still not dead. And he gets a rope from somewhere. Like, he just, you know, David Blaine some rope. And then he finishes Mrs. Ortega off with that. He gets another bag. And then he strangles the father with that one. Then he grabs Junior. He takes him into another room. He puts a shirt inside of the bag so that he can't bite a hole into it. He put that bag over his head and tied it with a Venetian blind cord, pulled up a chair, and watched the kid die.
Yikes.
Josephine was taken to the basement and quote-unquote semi-hung from a drainage pipe. She had not been sexually assaulted, but her pants were pulled around her ankles, and there was semen found on her leg. Rader then performed what he called the quote-unquote right-hand rule, cleaning up after himself inside of the crime scene. Took the keys from the house and drove the family car to Dylan's, which is a supermarket. Then he walked back to his car. Now, the police thought that this was the work of someone who really had it out for the Ortega family. And it really, really looks that way. Like, this was not the work of a rookie or someone that who hasn't done this type of work before. This job looked professional. The knots looked professional. The job looked, you know, well planned and thought out after everything is said and done. The planning and the follow through was just too good to have been a random occurrence, which most house robberies are. I thought I might introduce some more random facts about home invasions because,
you know, why not?
Everybody's at home more often, so like you don't really just hear about home invasions that often anymore, right? 65% of burglars are already well acquainted with the people they rob. Only 12% of home invasions are planned in advance. New Mexico has the highest burglary rate with 667.8 burglaries per 100,000 people, with New Hampshire being the lowest at 136.2 per 100,000 people. There are almost 3 burglaries every minute in the United States, and on average 1 every 26 seconds. 85% of home invasions are not conducted by professional burglars. 62% of burglaries happen during daylight hours, meaning when your ass is at work. 88% of burglars may be robbing to support their drug habit, i.e. your mom, or your sister, or your brother, or your cousin, or that one aunt. You know which one I'm talking about. Burglaries in the United States have dropped by 37% since 2008. And I'm like I just said, they probably dropped way more since everybody's been at home all day. Especially people working from home. Wink, wink. But anyway, there's your random facts from Rashad for the day. So the police, they widen the net and search Wichita, Kansas for similar crimes. Then the state for similar crimes. Then the country for similar crimes. The FBI gets involved to search for similar crimes, but no dice. Now, we've been talking serial killers, this entire time. Like, since this show existed, we've been talking about people who've done the unimaginable, comma, but none like this. The home invasion type serial killer type. A more well-planned Richard Ramirez, if you will. Mass shootings? Sure, we've talked about them. Family wipeouts? Yeah, let's talk about them right now. But so far this season, we've talked about eating people, wearing people, sexual mutilation, killing people just for sexual gratification. And this episode is not going to get any better. Trigger warning. Right here. Right now. Boom. It's done. Here's a little tidbit about Dennis Lynn Rader, a.k.a. BTK. This is a source from Murderpedia.com. He is the eldest of 4 sons born to William Elvin Rader and Dorothy May Cook. Though born in Pittsburgh, Kansas, he grew up in Wichita, attended Riverview High School, and later graduated from Wichita Heights High School in 1957. He was confirmed into the Zion Lutheran Church. I'm not sure if that's conformed. It should probably say conformed, right? Whatever. Thank you, Murderpedia. According to several reports, including his own confessions, as a child he tortured animals, one of the warning signs in the McDonald Triad. He also harbored a sexual fetish for women's underwear. He would later steal panties from his victims and wear them himself. He did that. Rader attended Kansas Wesleyan University from 1965 to 1966. He subsequently spent 4 years in the United States Air Force, stationed in Texas, Alabama, Okinawa, South Korea, Greece, and Turkey. When he returned to the United States, he moved to Park City, a suburb located 7 miles north of Wichita. He worked for a time in the meat department of Leaker's IGA supermarket in Park City alongside his mother, a bookkeeper of the store. Rader attended Butler County Community College in El Dorado, earning an associate's degree in electronics in 1973. He enrolled in Wichita State University that same fall. He graduated from there in 1979 with a bachelor's degree in administration of justice. He married Paula Dietz, and on May 22, 1971, they had one son. From 1972 to 1973, Rader worked as an assembler for the Coleman Company, a camping gear firm. He then worked for a short time for Cessna in 1973, from November 1974 until being fired in July 1988. Rader worked at a Wichita-based office of ADT Security Services, a company that sold and installed alarm systems. How convenient. During Rader's years there, he sold alarm systems for commercial businesses as well as residential. He held several positions, including installation manager. It was believed that he learned how to defeat home security systems while employed. Police Chief Floyd Hannon told the Wichita Eagle in January of 1974, quote, "The way in which family members were slain indicates a fetish on the part of the assailant," unquote. Remember, he's got a thing for panties. Not even 3 months later, on April 4th, 1974, another vicious home invasion happened to the Bright family. This time, Rader was already in the house when Caitlin and her brother Kevin came home to 3217 East 13th Street at approximately 1 p.m. The Brights were confronted when they walked through the front door, but Rader didn't have plans for the brother to be there. He had been watching just Catherine. This is the part where I don't know if I said Caitlin or Catherine. I guess we'll figure it out later. But she lived alone. Armed with two guns this time instead of one, Rader fed them the same story of being wanted in California. He just wants the car, and he's just going to tie him up, and he's just going to leave. Spoiler alert. I always fuck that word up. Spoiler alert. No, he's not just going to tie them up and leave. So Kevin's first. He makes Kevin tie his sister up, then he ties Kevin up. At this point, I imagine both Brights are pretty bound. Rader goes to strangle Kevin first. He breaks the bonds, then Rader shoots him in the head. Mm-hmm. Boom. Done. Rader moves to the other bedroom to strangle Catherine, but it just wasn't working out.
Why'd you look so perplexed right there? What was that about?
She was fighting, you know, for her life. All right. Kevin gets back up. Yeah. Hello. Just got shot in the head. He's up.
Okay.
And another altercation ensues back in the other bedroom, where the result was another attempted strangulation, followed by another gunshot to the head of Kevin. Two gunshots, and he tried to choke him out. Back to Catherine. He's choking, and he's choking. And it's just not working out. Like, he's not, he's probably tired from the couple of tussles from the brother. that he had in the other bedroom. So he takes the easy way out and he stabs her 3 times in the abdomen, torso area. You know, she's leaking. There's blood everywhere. He's like, oh shit, I'm fucking up. This is supposed to be clean. Obviously, this is not. Raider goes back to check on Kevin, and Kevin is gone. Not that kind of gone. I mean, he left out of the front door with 2 gunshot wounds to the face. Got up and ran and got help. The only identification Kevin could give to the police was that it was a tall white male, which is pretty accurate. But, at the same time, a very vague description. What it does is open the door for crazies to try and take credit for something that they didn't do. And the police did their job taking every confession seriously. And there were a lot of false confessions, including from those already in prison. Raider did not approve of such nonsense. And he reached out to the newspaper himself, called the Wichita Eagle, and he basically told them that there was a letter in a book at the Wichita Library. It was in like an engineering book or something like that. The letter would tell them exactly what kind of monster that they were dealing with. The letter gave a description of the crime scene only the police or the killer would know. For example, Josephine, position, hanging by the neck in the northwest part of the basement, hand tied with bind cord, noose with 4 or 5 turns. That sort of shit. The letter goes on to say that he's already chosen his next victim or victims, and that the police can refer to him as bind them, torture them, kill them. Because that's what he does. Later shortened to BTK. At this point, the police are thinking, we gotta find this guy. Obviously. But there is no more correspondence between the BTK and the newspaper, or the police, or even any more murders for the rest of 1974 through 1976. Then, on March 17th, 1977, BTK came out of retirement and went to 1311 South Hydraulic Street residence. There lived Shirley Vianne and her 3 children. Now, this instance was, by his account, completely random. By chance, if you will. He initially had someone else in mind, but they weren't home. Then he went to another house and no one was home. But then he ran into this kid. Again, by chance. And he ran one of his ruses that he was working on. He asked the kid if he could identify some people in a picture. The kid was like 5. Obviously, he had no idea who the people in the picture were. So he let the kid go on his way, but he watched where the kid went. BTK knocked on the door and of the where he saw the child go, and the kid just, you know, kind of let him in. I think BTK said he was like some kind of like investigator or something like that. I've heard conflicting stories, but it's fine. Shirley, you know, his mom was inside of the house and she walked out to see who was at the door, and what do you know, she's face to face with the BTK and his loaded .357 Magnum. Needless to say, she was a little nervous. He told her that he was having some problems with his sexual fantasies, so he's switching up his story a bit. Shirley obliged to his weird way of hitting on a woman because she had no choice. It was either that or a dirt nap.
Naturally.
So she helped usher the children into the bathroom. They get the 3 kids into the bathroom and they, you know, they toss blankets and some toys in there. Then BTK, he tied the door shut and barricaded the other bathroom door with a bed. He then tied Shirley up, and then she was sexually assaulted, but during the sexual assault, Shirley vomited. Raider stopped sexually assaulting her. He got up and got some water, told her everything was going to be all right. You know?
Okay. You know, natural.
Was like, hey, this is just a one-time thing. Then he put a bag over her head and strangled her to death.
Ah. There it is.
Then the phone rang. Raider remembered that Shirley said her neighbor would be coming to check on her and the kids because she was sick or something. And Shirley was obviously not all right at this point, and the kids were obviously not all right at this point. BTK said it's time to go. So he packs up his little quote-unquote hit kit. Yeah, he's got hit kits now. Like, he's leveled up in the game. And he's got a briefcase with ropes, with pre-tied knots, sophisticated ass knots too, like also foreshadowing ass knots. So he's also got cord, various gloves he was testing, handcuffs, a gun, knives, entry tools, a flashlight tape to show a pinpoint of light, you know, like crazy shit. And sometimes a Polaroid camera or a mask. He also had quote-unquote hit clothes. Clothes that he would switch into so he could stabby stab stab. In one briefcase, he carried fake papers and a photo to use as a ruse. He also used stolen business cards. So there's all of that information to cover how he gained access to all of these places, persons, and things. So he packed up all that shit and left. December 8th, 1977, Nancy Fox became BTK's next project. I'm sorry if I have not mentioned that before, but he called all of his murders projects. As if he wanted some type of secret agent rating at the end of this mission, because this was a video game to him. Unfortunately, this was not a video game. A fantasy inside of fantasies. What are you laughing at?
I'm not
at?
Laughing. I'm... Okay. Just go ahead.
We talked about this in the Albert Fish episode about what happens when you obsess over something for so long. Shit goes dark. So the murder of Nancy Fox was, for the most part, a matter of convenience. He had been watching her, trolling her, stalking her, whatever you want to call it, for a couple of weeks. By then, he had his routine set up. Clip the phone lines, break in, wait. She came home and walked into the kitchen, and there stood BTK himself. Confessed that he had a sex addiction, and he was just there to relieve himself. After he allowed her to smoke a cigarette and use the restroom, very humane for someone as inhumane as BTK and what he's about to do next. So he handcuffs her to the bed, ties her feet, and proceeds to strangle her with a belt, masturbated, then did a quick sweep of the house and left. It's that quick for him. I mean, I'd imagine it was probably like 3 or 4 minutes. Like, as I'm reading about all these murders, I'm like, all right, this obviously took like 45 minutes to an hour to masturbate all over everybody and leave. But no, my man's like,
I can't stand it. Okay. Because you're making eye contact with me while you do this. But yeah, so he's growing chia pets all over everybody's house.
I mean, he's just at this point, they like in the 70s, you could just leave a bucket of jizz somewhere. They're gonna be like, I don't know who left this shit here, but that's a lot, and that's impressive. Like, that's all they can say. Like, that literally, they'd be like, in today's science, they'd be like, yeah, we can find the guy. He left a bucket of jizz here. BTK went down to a payphone and reported that there was a homicide at 843 South Perishing. I'm just running through the murders right now. Like, we might as well go ahead and, there's 10 of them. And, like, there are, it's just a lot. So I'm flush straight through this.
You know, do your thing.
Okay.
It's
January 31st, 1978, a poem written on an index card arrived at the Wichita Eagle Beacon. The poem was typeset in a children's handwriting, basically owning up to the Vianne murder. February 10th, BTK sends a letter to Cake, a television station he was a fan of. In the letter, he confessed to all of the murders so far and demanded media attention. This is the first time that the public is alerted of the serial killer in their midst by Police Chief Richard Lemonnier. This sent the public into a panic. But as far as the killings go, BTK is done for 1978 because his daughter was born that year. Detectives were dispatched all over the United States, just looking for any kind of clues, information, a case that was like this one that was happening in Wichita, and they found nothing. So the case went cold. BTK picked up where he left off on April 28, 1979. He broke inside the house of 615 South Pinecrest, the home of 63-year-old Ann Williams. He waited and waited and waited. And when she didn't come home, he left. He took some items from her home, mainly panties. But to make his presence felt, he sent her a letter. Inside was a poem entitled, "Oh Anna, Why Didn't You Appear?" And he drew a picture of what he wanted to do to Anna. Very graphic. You can tell he spent some time on it. There's like some, he's got like shading in there. Some cross hatching. I mean, like some serious art 101 skills. And I'm like, bro, like you had to sit there for a minute and draw that. But I digress. It wasn't that impressive. I mean, It's just because I went to art school. Like, as soon as I saw the picture, I was like, ooh, analyze, critique. But, like, I shouldn't have did that. But you can't turn that kind of stuff off when you're an art student. Sorry, not sorry. He also sent a letter to Cake again. In a nutshell, he wanted to let everybody know he was back. And, you know, getting it again. He was picking people off like wildflowers. Panic ensues. By late 1979, Wichitans had heard the voice of the person responsible for all of the murders from 1977. The 911 phone call that was playing on repeat from the radio and television. A tip line was set up, and on the first day, the police received over 100 tips. But BTK goes quiet again as far as murders go. The tips lead nowhere until a new investigation is launched in 1984 with advances in forensic science, including DNA testing. Granted, very, very early and not very, very good DNA testing, but it's like on the table now. They're like, hey, we can do this, but maybe not right now. Just hold on to what you got. Also foreshadowing, it's going to come up again later. But they also add in psychological profiling and computer database searching by, you know, the continuous adding of everything everybody's wrote down for the past, I don't know, like 50 years, and just piling it in a computer so, like, everybody can see it all at the same time. So with that, the police had hundreds of suspects with all that. The team that was put together, like the special unit, or the
unit,
they were called the quote unquote Ghostbusters. The media dubbed the name because of, in their opinion, they were just looking for a ghost. Like, they were not going to find the BTK. Like, they were looking for a nobody. The police thought they were looking for someone that was a police officer or wanted to be a police officer. The killer was either a WSU student or had gone to the university. More than likely, the killer was a sex offender or was a sex offender that hadn't been caught yet. So they had kind of no fucking clue who they were looking for. What they knew for sure was that if they played to his ego and gave the killer enough rope... Mm-hmm. He would eventually hang himself.
There you go.
So April 1985, a Park County resident, Maureen Hedge, goes missing from her home at 6254 Independence, seven houses down from BTK's house. He had gone through with his usual to-do list before the encounter, and since she lived on his street, it was easy to watch her. He had this elaborate plan to establish an alibi. He parked his car in a bowling alley. Inside of the bowling bag that he took inside of the bowling alley was his hit kit. He changed clothes and used some beer for mouthwash and called a taxi. He asked the cab driver to pull over because he, quote, needed some fresh air because he was drunk, unquote. From there, he walked the rest of the way to Maureen Hedges' house. So he'd been watching her, right? So when he got there, he thought that he'd have time to break in, bust a couple nervous nuts, then hide and wait. But lo and behold, her car was in the driveway on this day. So he thought, well, fuck. Time to improvise. BTK snuck into the house only to realize that no one was home. So he went back to his original plan to hide in the house until she returned. What he also didn't plan for was her basically, like, he didn't plan for her to be with anyone. She had a male visitor that day. So he had to wait. He doesn't want a repeat of what happened last time. He planned for something that didn't go right. After the male visitor left, BTK waited until Maureen went to bed. He waited until the early morning hours until he came out of hiding in one of her spare bedrooms, crept into her room, and hit the lights. She screams, obviously. BTK jumps on top of her in the bed and strangles her to death, stripped all of her clothes off, bound her, put her in the trunk of her own car, then took some souvenirs from the house, took the car over to Christ Lutheran Church, and took some pictures of her with his Polaroid camera. May 2nd, Hedges' car was found at 21st and Woodlawn. On the 3rd, her purse was found in a ditch near 143rd and 37th North. And on the 5th, Maureen Hedges' body was found near 53rd and Webb Road. When the body was discovered, she was nude and badly decomposed. BTK had thrown the pantyhose used to strangle her in a nearby ditch. That was all the evidence that they had at the time. September 16th, 1986, BTK chose his next victim, Vicky Weggerly, a mother of two. BTK had a ruse of being a telephone repairman this time around. You know, the guy that comes around with the helmet and the clipboard. You've seen him. I know you have. And you don't think twice about where they work when you see him. So using that ruse, he knocked on her door and told her that they were doing work on the telephone lines in her area and asked if he could check her telephone. Don't know what he had to check inside the house besides if the phone was working or not, but hey, fuck it. He's in the house now. He pretended to be working on the phone until her back was turned, then drew a pistol. He requested that she join him in the bedroom. Weggerly became upset and fought, or at least she tried to fight BTK. After she was able to break free from the bindings, he was able to get the upper hand and strangled her with a nylon sock. She's not dead yet. She's just unconscious, because he's terrible at strangling people. She told him that her husband was on the way home prior to the strangling, so BTK had to be quick. Also, all of the windows in the house were open, and the dogs in the backyard were going ape shit. He snapped a couple photos, packed up his hit kit, grabbed her car keys, and left. Her car would be found two blocks away. Initially, the husband took the hit for this because the way the body was left at the scene was hidden from view by, you know, their bed. So she had been there for a minute after the husband got home. He's looking around. He finds his kid there, you know, one of his kids, but he doesn't see the mom. 30-45 minutes goes by. He finds her on the other side of the bed. So some time goes by after that. No leads leading to an arrest for the Vicky Weggerly murder. No tips on the books to even lead investigators to a suspect. So in 1988, Special Unit, the Ghostbusters, in search of the infamous BTK killer, was disbanded. January 19th, 1991, BTK strikes again. 1.5 mile east of Park City was the house of Dolores Davis. Raider was supposed to be on a camping trip with the troop he was chaperoning on this night. Well, he was there, but he was also at Dolores' house, too. BTK had cased that place before, you know, done his usual homework, but he couldn't figure out how to get inside of the house, so he just threw a concrete brick through her patio window. Very brazen. But the ruse this time was the same as the Otero murder. He was on the run, he needed food, he needed warmth, it was really cold that night. If she did what he said, she'd be fine. He comforted her, he talked to her for a minute, he also handcuffed her. You know, it's cool. Just make sure I know where your hands are. He mocked stealing some things. He didn't really want anything. He grabbed her car keys. He uncuffed her. He tied her up. And then he strangled her with some pantyhose. He loaded her body into the trunk of her car and took her to location one. He took the clothes and stuff that he used for the murder and dropped that off in location two. He took her car back to her house, location 3, and dropped it off there, only to realize that he lost one of his guns. Goes back into location 3, finds the gun, threw her car keys onto the top of her roof, and then walked back to his car, location 4. Went back to location 1, where he dropped the body off, picked her back up, and placed her body underneath a bridge near 117th North and Meridian, location 5. Then he left. A teenage kid discovered the body. She was still tied up and in the middle of decomp. The signature pantyhose was found along with multiple bonds, showing that BTK was just having fun at this point. He was basically doing the Alcala thing where he would strangle them until they pass out and then revive them, only to do it again and again. Nearby was a porcelain mask the police believe that the killer used. Well, they know that he used it, because when they find all these pictures that we're going to talk about later, it was the same mask. I'll bring it up later. Now, this is the end of the murders for BTK. The police had lost every battle trying to catch him, but the war was far from over. Oh no. 10 people in a relatively small area of Kansas had been brutally tortured and murdered. We're going to find him. But the cat and mouse games were just starting. They did think that he was maybe already incarcerated, maybe skipped town, or the country. Or maybe he was just dead. But some, maybe a few, just a small few, thought that he was still nearby, possibly in town, and itching to get back into the game. In fact, Raider was working on his career. He was hired by the Park City as the compliance and animal control officer, meaning he was part of law enforcement, kinda. Very efficient, very friendly, but also strict. And a dick. Raider served on 2 boards in Park City. He was also elected to the church council, serving as vice president. Very active in all of his many jobs, with his 2 kids grown and have either flown the coop or in school, Raider began to get bored. So he began to get that itch again. So in an article that comes out that, you know, BTK is dead or believed to be dead or maybe off killing somewhere else, the people of Wichita started to forget about all of the murder cases. Like, I think it was like an article where they asked some college students about BTK, and they were like, we don't know anything about this guy. We know BRB. That's what we know. LOL.
You happy about that? You good about that?
GTFO. A man named Robert Beatty set out to write a book about BTK as early as 2003. The internet started talking about it. Then the Wichita Eagle ran an article for the 30th anniversary of the Otero murders and the BTK killings in January of 2004. Remember, Raider did not want anyone taking credit for his work, So on March 19th, Rader mailed a letter to the Wichita Eagle under the name Bill Thomas Kilman. BTK. Inside were three photocopied pictures of photos from his personal collection from the murder of Vicki Wegerle, taken in 1986. In the pictures, her body was purposefully posed. Also inside the letter was a photocopy of her driver's license, a piece of evidence never recovered from the crime scene. Lastly, the letter was signed with the symbol used to sign his other letters sent back in the 70s and 80s. It was basically a B with titties, and the T and K combined together to make like a stick figure type deal. Well, I might try and find a way to post it on Instagram. At that time, BTK was not tied to this murder. Investigators only tied seven of the murders to BTK. But this letter was basically his way of taking credit for the Wegerle murder. So, panic ensues. A new task force was formed to basically crack this case and catch BTK. But what this task force had that the others didn't was BTK's DNA. With further advances in forensic science on their side, they were now more confident in catching the killer. There was DNA testing back in the 80s and the 90s, but it was so early in technology that if they used up the blood and the skin DNA recovered from the fingernails of the Wegerle case and the semen from the Otero and Fox case, that was it. There was no more semen. So, the investigation made the wise decision of waiting to test all of this evidence when the technology was readily available. So they have the DNA sample, something they can use. And from the tips collected, 5,000 men were interviewed. From that, 1,700 men were swabbed, no matches. May 4th, 2004, second letter arrived at Cake TV. The return address on the letter belonged to Thomas B. King. This guy's clever. This guy knows how to use words and rearrange them sometimes.
So he went with TBK.
The address was also fake, so I could tell you right now he lived on Sesame Street, and it would be just as real as the address that he used on the letter. But for research purposes, the address was 408 Clayton Street. The letter contained a chapter page for the quote-unquote BTK story. Chapter 1, A Killer is Born. Chapter 2, Dawn. Chapter 3, Fetish. Chapter 4, Fantasy World. Chapter 5, The Search Begins. Chapter 6, BTK's Haunts. Chapter 7, PJs. Chapter 8, MOID Ruse. Chapter 9, Hits. Chapter 10, Treasured Memories. Chapter 11, Final Curtain Call. Chapter 12, Dusk. And finally, Chapter 13, Will There More? Question mark. And I know you may have a question. Will there more? Of course there will. But you'll have to wait until next week to hear the rest of the story. That is part one of the BTK case. We have a Patreon episode coming up this week as well. So if you want to check that out, or just shoot over to our Patreon. Extra episodes start at $1. We have multiple tiers. You can get a whole bunch of stuff. You can also hit us up on our socials, Instagram at Blood and Firewater Podcast, and Snapchat and Twitter at BFW Pod Squad. Other than that, stay alert and stay alive, because this episode takes a mean twist.